The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dungshan's Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. The Dharma of thusness is intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it. Keep it well. Fill in a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight. When you array them, they're not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. If you're excited, it becomes a pitfall. If you miss it, you fall into retrospective hesitation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like a mass of fire. So as we're completing our vigil, our Buddha's Enlightenment vigil, I was thinking about what would be appropriate. And so this poem, I've been wanting to give a series of talks on this poem for a while, so I thought I would do that during the winter. And these are just the first few lines, and today I'll probably only get to the first couple lines because I wanted to concentrate on that today. But I thought it would be a good way also of bringing this vigil to a conclusion. Dungshan, as many of you know, is a very important part of our lineage. In fact, the name in the Japanese Soto, or in Chinese Tsaodong, Tsaodong, was taken from Dungshan's name and one of his principal disciples, Tsaoshan. So Tsaodong is from Tsao and Dong of those two teachers. And they lived in the 9th century of China. And Dungshan, in particular, was known for his teachings of the five ranks, which I speak about, and is one expression that appears in many different forms in Zen and in other traditions of the interpenetration. What is the relationship between the absolute and relative, between the unspoken and the spoken? This poem is a teaching by Master Dungshan, and there are many poems. It's one of the wonderful sort of gifts of Buddhism that up to the world is of these songs, these singing poems. And there are teachers like Milarepa who are known for literally singing the teachings. In a sense, when we chant, we're singing the teachings. So this poem was a very important teaching of his that he gave to us. So in this vigil, we've been sitting throughout the weekend. The Zendo has been continuously alive and populated with practitioners. What are we celebrating? What is it that has been transmitted down generation after generation? Why does this monastery exist? There are so many forms of practice, so many teachings, so many ways in which the Dharma takes form or shape in a teaching, in a practice. All of the tangible things that we use, altars, images, incense, robes, the precepts, in essence, it all comes down to the Dharma of thusness is intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors. That is really the sum total of the purpose of Buddhism. Now, not every Buddhist may agree with that. But in terms of our training, my training, in terms of what the Buddha taught, it wasn't all that he taught, but it was what he devoted his life's work to. Now you have it. Keep it well. The Dharma of thusness. The just thisness. Mazumi Roshi said that the word shikan in shikantaza, shikan means to not divide. So just this means this undivided. Free of past, present, and future. It is free of form and sensation, perception, formations, and consciousness. It is free of denial and clinging, of letting go, of going beyond letting go. It's free of freedom. It is the primordial mind that is the essence or the utterness of simplicity, in the sense of being utterly uncontrived, unadorned. It is always ever-present and functions freely in this world of phenomena, but it is free of discrimination. It is your very nature. It is my nature. Dharmata is the nature of Dharma. The Dharma of thusness is intimately conveyed. In the enlightenment of the Buddha, he recounts the stages of his enlightenment, where he saw into the deep nature of karma. He saw into past lives, and he saw into dependent arising. And he taught all of that and expounded on all of that, but always within everything is the Dharma of thusness. This title of the poem, The Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, or The Precious Mirror Samadhi, Master Sheng Yan, who has a commentary on this poem, said, "The precious mirror is a symbol of the foundation of all dharmas, the source of all sentient beings, the substance of all Buddhas." And you see the mirror used much in Buddhist teaching. Many other names and terms referring to the same thing exist. At different times, he says, I may refer to it as self-nature, or pure nature, or original nature. Someone was asking about that recently, about the use of the word nature. And I said, you know, if we think about nature, you know, what we think of as nature, which is that which human beings have not created, mountains and rocks and rivers and skies, and that in a way it is a good word to bring in and use, associate with self-nature, with true nature. If we think of nature as being, in its complexity, in its profound complexity, also utterly simple, because it is just itself. A tree, a rock, a cloud, a sky, it's just itself. It has no ambition. It's not trying to present. It doesn't compete. It doesn't compete. When a tree seeks sunlight, it's not competing with other trees. That's what we may call it, because we compete, but it's not competing. It's just living and searching for life. And so in a way, nature has so many nice qualities to bring to that sense of self-nature, Dharma nature, Buddha nature. He says in the Avatamsaka Sutra, it's called the one true Dharma realm. In the Lotus Sutra, it's called the one true nature. In the Nirvana Sutra, it's called the Great Nirvana, the secret store, or Buddha nature. In the Sharingama Sutra, it's called the Tathagatagarbha, the womb of the Buddha. The Yogacara school refers to it as the Alaya consciousness, or the great perfect mirror wisdom. In the end, however, it's best just to remember that these are just names. They're just names. They're important. They help us. They evoke. They point. But they're just names. This precious jewel mirror samadhi is intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors. Samadhi is often equated or synonymous with concentration, which is okay. I mean, I didn't decide that. It's a good term. It also fails in so many ways. Concentration can have such a kind of singular, sort of two-dimensional aspect. We just concentrate on something. And it doesn't bring in the full depth of samadhi as it's understood in Buddhism and what it is, how we cultivate it, how we experience it. And we tend to think of it in fairly narrow terms as being in a state of concentration, but it's much, much more than that. And so to think of this jewel mirror samadhi as being, having the qualities of or being expressed as a jewel mirror. Longchenpa, the Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist master, said awareness, your basic awareness, which is your enlightened mind, your primordial mind, because it's empty, it's like the sky. And so that image of the sky is so marvelous. It's so large. It's endless. It has no boundary. We may see it only to a certain extent, but that's just the limit of our vision. Its characteristic is luminous, this mind. And so he said it's like the sun and the moon, which radiate and reflect brilliant light that shines equally everywhere. And this awareness, because its cognitive potency is the basis for all manifestation. And this is really getting closer to the importance of samadhi, the cognitive potency. And there's a lot in that term. What does that mean? Because of that, it's like the limpid surface of a mirror. All of this in your basic awareness. So little wonder then that we should devote ourselves so single-mindedly to cultivating. And it's not really cultivating our awareness because it's already full. It's already fully itself. It's fully aware, fully empty, fully luminous, fully potent. But our apprehension of it is not. And so it seems dim or even absent, right? We say, I lost my awareness. Where did it go? We don't live without it, so we're still living. So it's not that it goes anywhere, but something does happen. And in that something space, that's everything the country music is singing about, is what happens in that space. And so, of course it's beyond words. Of course it's ungraspable. Of course it has to be beyond time and space. How else could it have come down to us? Complete. So rather than be frustrated when we encounter its ungraspability, our inability to capture it in language, we should celebrate it. Yes, of course, I can't express it. Of course, I will never know its end. Hallelujah. It is that large. If we are going to devote ourselves to something as we do, it should be so large. It should be so vast. It should be something that will both illuminate and challenge our lives forever. About this old mirror, Dogen has a fascicle. And he says, what all Buddhas and ancestors have maintained and transmitted person to person is this old mirror. This is one scene, one face, one image, one casting, one practice, one realization. When the old comes before this old mirror, the old appears. When the new comes, the new is shown. When a Buddha comes, a Buddha appears. When an ancestor comes, an ancestor shows up. There's a story about the 18th ancestor, Jayashata, that his mother, before he was born, had a dream, and in the dream there was a great deity who was looking into a very large mirror, and very soon after that, she conceived. And in 7 very concentrated days, she gave birth. And when he was born with a clear round mirror, an ancient mirror. Dogen says this was extraordinary. And he says, born together doesn't mean that the round mirror came from his mother's womb. He said, Jayashata was born from his mother's womb, but at the time of his birth, the mirror appeared spontaneously close and became his everyday companion. This mirror itself was not ordinary. As the boy approached, the mirror would stand up as if it were being held by his hands and would reflect his face. When he went away, the mirror would follow him, reflecting his body. When he slept, the mirror would cover him like a canopy. When he sat up, the mirror would be in front of him, and so it accompanied him in all of his activities. Dogen says, all the Buddha teachings from the past, present, and future could be seen in this mirror. Every aspect of heavenly and human affairs were clearly reflected in this mirror. It could reveal any teaching, ancient or current. However, when the boy left home and received the precepts, entered the way, the mirror disappeared. Where did it go? This mirror, this jewel mirror samadhi, is your mind, your self nature. It has all of these great qualities. Sometimes it's very present. The more we practice, Dogen is saying, there are moments where it disappears. Is that because it is so fully integrated? Is that because it's been forgotten? So to not look outside of this bright mirror, and so as Dogen says, it could reveal any teaching, past or present, more clearly than the scriptures. And so there again, it's wholly appropriate, necessary, that when we sit, we would turn inward towards this mirror. Then in essence, you yourself are the sutra. You contain every teaching that has ever been offered. And when we realize self-nature, when we realize this jewel mirror samadhi, when we realize this sutra, that's just another way of saying realizing this body and mind. And so all of these encouragements and our admonitions about encouragements not to turn away, to not go seeking outside of ourselves, is because it's here. And so Dzogchen says, intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors, you have it. Keep it well. Intimately conveyed. What is this intimacy? When the student was on a pilgrimage and encountered a teacher, and the teacher said, what is the purpose of your pilgrimage? And the student said, I don't know. And the teacher said, not knowing, most intimate. What is this intimacy? Dogen speaks about this as intimate language. And this language is not of an ordinary kind, but it includes every form of expression in the human realm. The meaning of this intimate language is not in words, and yet words can enlighten the mind to this intimate language. This intimate language is intimate communication. It is intimate contact. Taza means sitting upright. So shikantaza means sitting upright with no division, nothing divided. This is intimate language. And so when I spoke this morning at the end of our, before we lifted the silence, about how in our practice, the more we study, the more we see, the more we experience, the more we understand, we see how that in any moment there will be certain things that will be in our awareness, in our cognition, But there is so much that is not yet revealed there. Some of it will be revealed later in our cognition. So Longchenpa speaks of the cognitive potency that becomes more and more potent, more powerful, more liberating. But also of that which is will never come into our cognition and yet is there. And that we have senses of through intimate language. Dogen tells a story of a minister who came to Master Hongzhui and said, the world honored one, the Buddha, had intimate language. Mahakasyapa did not conceal it. He's referring to a dialogue about this. And the minister says, what was the world honored one's intimate language? And the master said, Your Excellency. And the minister responded, Yes. And the master said, Do you understand? And the minister said, No, I don't. And the master said, If you don't understand it, this is the world honored one's intimate language. If you do understand it, this is my Kashyapa, not concealing it. It cannot be given in words. It cannot be received in words. And so we practice. We practice to open up that gate, which has never been closed, into this realm of intimate language, intimate communication, intimate contact. I mean, think about it. When, you know, if you can think about, for some of you, this will be easy, for others it might be harder, but think about when you first encountered the Dharma, when you first encountered a teaching, or the first time when you felt something that was magnetic, that was like an attraction, an affinity, a knowing somehow. That looking, standing back, in a way you could say, I have no right to have this experience. I don't know what they're talking about. I don't understand this. I don't even know what it is yet. And yet, there's that sense. Something has been communicated that is intimate. If you try to describe it, you watch those words just fall to the floor, right? They cannot capture that experience. What is that? In practice, we train to understand understanding and understand not understanding, and to know the two. Bodhidharma says, when you understand through intimate language, through intimate contact, when you understand that which cannot be communicated, then reality depends on you. When you don't understand, then you depend on reality, which is a very pithy way of describing dukkha, samsara. We depend on things to fulfill us, to complete us, to affirm us, to deliver us. When we do understand, Bodhidharma says, then the world depends on us. When reality depends on you, that which appeared false before, now you see is true, is complete, is dharmanta, has dharma nature, is this ancient mirror. When you depend on reality, that which is actually true and complete appears false and insufficient. Right? So then it makes sense why we're constantly like, you know, it's like making a cake and then you add some layer of icing and then you add another layer and then another layer and then another layer. It never seems quite enough. And then we eat it and get sick. So Dogen said we should aspire to investigate for eons. As he often said, investigate, examine this thoroughly, and then examine it still more. How did the Buddha use his precious jewel mirror samadhi? You already know, because here you are. He says in several of the sutras that after his enlightenment, he said, the thought came to me. This dharma that I've attained is deep. It's difficult to see. It's hard to realize. It is peaceful. And the chorus from the wing sings out, and people are not. It is refined. And the chorus calls out and says, we're so attracted to the course. It is beyond the scope of conjecture. And this choir sings, and we love our conjecture. It is subtle, and we love the gross. It is to be experienced by the wise, and we're working on it, or not. But this generation, he said, delights in attachment, is excited by attachment, enjoys attachment. For a generation such as this, this conditionality and dependent co-arising that he was just enlightened to, that he saw into the inner workings of how this works, of how we construct our suffering, of how we construct all of our unhappiness. He said, this is hard to see. The resolution of all of these fabrications, these formations that we create in our mind, and the relinquishment of all of our acquisitions, all the things we work so hard to obtain and then preserve. He said, the end of craving, cessation and binding, this will be very difficult. He said, if I were to teach the Dharma, others would not understand, and I would just be, they would be, that would be tiresome for me and troublesome for me. Like he sees it all playing out, right? A kind of fruitless effort. And so he says, in that moment, a verse came to me that I had never heard before, thought before, enough now with teaching. What only with difficulty can be reached. This dharma is not easily realized by those overcome with aversion and passion. What is abstruse, subtle, deep, hard to see, going against the flow, those delighting in passion, cloaked in the mass of darkness, will not see. And as I reflected thus, my mind inclined to dwelling at ease and to not teaching the dharma. You think of the precipitousness of this moment, right? From that perspective. And then the Brahma Samapati, who in the Buddhist realm is a heavenly deity, one of the great sort of chief deities of the Brahma heaven, and was considered a protector of the teachings. And so he is hearing all this happening in the Buddha's mind, and thinks, the world is lost, the world is destroyed. The mind of the Tathagata, the rightly self-awakened one, inclines to dwelling at ease and not teaching the Dharma. And so Samapati went to where the Buddha was and appeared. And this is the Buddha recounting this story. And arranging his upper robe over one shoulder, knelt down with his right knee on the ground, saluted the Buddha with his hands before his heart and said, Lord, let the blessed one teach the Dharma. Let the well-gone one teach the Dharma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are falling away because they do not hear the Dharma. There will be those who will understand. We should have a memorial day for Samapata, right? This hero who showed up at just the right moment. And then, having awakened out of compassion for beings, the Buddha said, having understood the Brahma's invitation, the Buddha said, I surveyed the world with the eye of an awakened one. He shifted his perspective. And now he saw it differently. As I did so, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes, and those with much, those with keen faculties inclined towards the Dharma, and those not so. Those with attributes good and necessary for practicing the Dharma, and those where those are not developed. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses might flourish while immersed in the water without rising up from the water. Some might stand at an even level, and some rise above the water and aren't even touched by it. All of these different kinds of beings, all lotuses. And so the Buddha said, having seen this, I answered Brahmasamapati and said, open are the doors to the deathless, to those with ears. Let them show their conviction. Perceiving trouble, O Brahma, I did not tell people the refined, sublime Dharma. But now, realizing that there are those who would want to hear the Dharma of suchness intimately conveyed from Buddhas and ancestors. That's such an incredible moment. For a long time when I would hear those words, I would think, well, God, you know, come on. It's like, don't be lazy, you know. So be troubled a little bit, right? Get tired out a little bit on our behalf, if you would, please. But I read it that differently now. That first he was really seeing it as trying to bring the Dharma to someone who's not asking. Maybe you had that experience or just had the experience of trying to help someone who's not asking for help. They might be sick and not know it. They might be in trouble and not know it. They might have made a comfortable place with that sickness or that trouble. I hear it more that way. It wasn't that it would be tiresome for him. He would just create trouble for everybody. And that's such an important aspect of Buddhist practice. We have to open our own ears and mind. As the Buddha said, open are the doors, show your conviction. Right? Each of us brought ourselves here and brings ourselves here every day. You bring yourself to the cushion. On Friday night when I said, how would you practice, right, if everything that you've seen so far was in you? Your desire to live this life, to be free in this life. And suddenly everyone disappeared. Every practitioner, every teaching. No one's watching. There are no monasteries to go to. There are no ranks and levels. How would we practice? What would motivate us? Would we be motivated? Of course, it's so fabulous to have all of this. What a weak word. And everything is non-dual. In everything there is medicine, and in everything there is illness. And so that thought, imagining, is a way of just trying to shake ourselves free of any aspects that may be clinging to us about the Dharma, about training, about practice, about upaya, that we are using in a not wholly useful way. And when you shake yourself free, what you're left with is you, naked and complete. And so I feel an immense gratitude to the Buddha beyond words. Open are the doors to the deathless with those, to those with ears. Let them show their conviction. We can be here today because of that. Because not only did he refuse to accept that life was a struggle and seemed necessarily so, he wasn't buying it. And he was living at the top. But further, he spent the whole of his life. I mean, think about it. He could have lived a life of ease. Instead, he spent the whole of his life teaching and forming a community and establishing rules and dealing with problems. Right? All kinds of problems, big problems, insurrections within the Sangha, wars, conflicts that he was able to mediate and pacify, and ones that he was not able to, and just watched people kill and be killed. In his final moment, in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which is a really glorious, long sutra, original teaching. There's also a Nirvana Sutra that is Mahayana, but in the final moment, the Buddha is surrounded by those who could get there, as the word spread that he was getting ready to pass. And he turned to them and he said, and this is after a whole series, it could be like an incredible, dramatic presentation. I mean, it's an incredible story, this last period of the Buddha. But he turns to the students and he said, if even a single one of you has any doubt or perplexity concerning the Buddha or the Dharma or the Sangha, the path or the practice, ask. Ask me now. Don't later regret that the teacher was face to face with you, but you didn't bring yourself to ask a question in his presence. And everyone was silent. And the Buddha said, if even a single one of you has any doubt or any perplexity, ask now. And everyone was silent. And he asked again. Then the Buddha addressed the students, saying, now, if it's simply out of respect for the teacher that you don't ask, let a companion inform. In other words, whisper to somebody next to you. I mean, are you kidding? He's dying. He's moments away from death. All the monks were silent. And so then he said, so then, now I exhort you. All fabrications, all conditioned existence is subject to ending and decay. Reach consummation through your heedfulness. And then he passed. To the very end of his life, his very last words were about what his whole life had been about. Us. Us in the form of those in front of him. The predecessors of us. Such an incredible act of generosity, love, faith. You know, it's interesting, he also, as he was dying, said a few very important things. And one of the things he said was that to my Kashyapa Ananda, he said, among the minor rules of the Vinaya, which is this essential aspect of the early practice, he says, you can omit those. But he didn't say which ones. He didn't say which ones. And that led to a lively debate. And since they couldn't ascertain which ones he meant, they decided they would leave all of them. And as I was just studying this, preparing for the talk, I thought, I wonder if he was just causing some trouble right there at the end. So, may we reflect on our good fortune, our good karma, that has brought us to this Dharma, to this Sangha. And at a time and a place where we can actually do this. And that we can be those who step through those doors with our conviction to enter into that unbroken stream of the Dharma of thusness conveyed generation to generation. Now you have it, protect it well. I wanted to end with the last Dharma words of Maizumi Roshi. The Dharma of suchness has been transmitted intimately from Buddhas and ancestors. It has been conveyed generation after generation down to me. To complete or not to complete is of no consequence. Enlightenment above enlightenment, delusion within delusion is also of no consequence. Manifest again, Jokon, the koan of every moment, the precious jewel samadhi of every moment. Manifest this. Play freely in inward and outward, fulfilling samadhi. Maintain and nourish the one Buddha mind seal. Life after life, rebirth after rebirth, practice diligently. Do not regress. Do not let the wisdom seed of the Buddhas and ancestors be discontinued. Thus, I deeply implore you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.